From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, the philosopher Roman Kruznarek is joining us to talk about empathy. He's been studying the idea for more than a dozen years now, figuring out what it is and how it works. And what he's learned is that most of us don't really understand the idea all that well. Kruznarek says empathy is not some fluffy, feel-good word. It can be radical, even dangerous, but it offers the possibility of actual change. Empathy, he says, can fix stuff. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the philosopher and writer Roman Kruznarek is joining us to explain what he's learning about empathy. For more than a decade, he's been exploring this subject, and one of the things he's learned is that we are hardwired for empathy. That is, we've evolved impulses for social connection, which, yes, runs counter to another impression we have about human evolution, that we're all self-centered creatures only interested in preserving our own gene pool. Kruznarek says humans, in fact, are social animals who thrive on connection, not isolation. But, and this is a big one, we're not really using our potential for empathy very well. We're suppressing that part of ourselves. And that's what his book is about, using empathy for change, for radical change. He says that empathy can help us in social issues and environmental ones, even with our political mess. The book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman Kruznarek is a philosopher and a writer. His books include The Wonder Box, How Should We Live? And we should also say he's a founding faculty member of the School of Life based in London. It offers programs and classes in living well. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Oxford. And Roman Kruznarek, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the program, Doug.
I wanted to begin, if you wouldn't mind telling a little bit about this epiphany you had about empathy. I'm not sure how long ago it was, but you write about it in your book. It was related to how you were thinking about your mother's death. You had a kind of personal revelation, kind of an epiphany about empathy. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I've actually been interested in empathy for about a dozen years and used to be an academic studying politics and sociology and left it all to study empathy, which of course is the art of stepping into the shoes of other people and looking at the world through their eyes. But in fact, it was only a couple of years ago that I had this epiphany you referred to where I really recognized what was driving me to be so interested in empathy. And actually, I was sitting in my little study in Oxford in England thinking about my mother's death when I was 10 years old as a young boy growing up in Australia in Sydney in the suburbs. And what happened to me when my mum died was something quite common, which was that a lot of my memories from before that age disappeared. I lost those memories, which is common in trauma cases for young children. But the other thing that happened was I realized that I'd lost my empathy. I lost that ability to really feel other people's feelings, to feel emotions like joy or sadness and respond to others' suffering. And you know that feeling you sometimes have when you're very distant from people, you can almost look down at your own life. That's the kind of feeling I had growing up after she died. And I realized in my epiphany that, in fact, my driving interest in empathy was motivated by an unconscious desire to recover the empathic self I'd lost as a child. So in a sense, the book I've just written has been something of a personal quest.
So does that happen to us then? Something traumatic in our lives can short-circuit that wiring that we'll talk about?
That is right, actually, that for some people, your empathy potential that we're all born with does get short-circuited by traumatic events. But more generally, I think what happens is that society and culture erodes our empathy very slowly. It happens through political ideologies which enter our minds, which make us treat other people as being of less worthy, you know, than ourselves. It happens through the advertising industry, which keeps telling us, you know, to look after ourselves all the time, to look after number one, where the question, what's in it for me, becomes the leading question on our minds and on our lips. And all these things, in a way, bring out that individualistic side of ourselves, which is very much part of who we are, but it doesn't really do much to nurture that more empathic side that, as you said, is wired into us. It's part of our evolutionary makeup. We're just as much homo empathicus as we are self-interested creatures.
I guess we should define our terms here, because as you point out in the book, and right up front, in fact, a lot of the time we think of empathy as this fuzzy, feel-good emotion. And this is an important point you make in the book. It's more complicated than that. You take a kind of different view about that. What is empathy?
You're absolutely right. There are a lot of confusions about empathy. People tend to associate it with just sort of general kindness, a kind of soft and fluffy concept. But if you open a psychology textbook, you'll see that there are two definitions of empathy in there, two different kinds. It's really important to understand them. The first kind is what's called affective empathy, spelt with an A, which is empathy as a shared or mirrored emotional response. So if you, for example, see anguish on a child's face and you too feel anguish, that is affective empathy. You're sharing or mirroring their emotions. Now, if you see anguish on a child's face and feel a different emotion, you feel, you know, for example, oh, the poor little thing, you feel sorry for them, pity, that's what's known as sympathy, which is an emotional response, but one that isn't shared. And it's actually very interesting that Google searches for the word empathy have more than doubled in the last decade, but the frequency of searches for sympathy are down by 30%. So the first kind of empathy is affective empathy. Flip over the page in the psychology textbook and you get what's called cognitive empathy or perspective-taking empathy. That's where you really try to imagine, what is it like to be another person? You know, for example, a homeless guy you walk past, you imagine, what's it like to sleep out on a cold winter's night? What's it like to be walked past without somebody looking you in the eye? And this cognitive empathy enables us to respond to other people's needs.
Empathy is not the same as the golden rule. I think people get that confused.
Absolutely. So the golden rule, which is this moral principle which exists in all religions, have come up with it, which is the idea of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, which is a useful idea and a moral principle. But the great Irish writer George Bernard Shaw once said, do not do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. They might have different tastes. Right. And so empathy, particularly cognitive empathy, is about discovering those different tastes. Yeah. And just to give you an example of how it plays out in everyday life. I mean, I've got twins, a boy and a girl, and they're now 6 years old. But when they were younger, I saw how this cognitive ability developed. So when they're about 1.5, before their natural empathy kicked in, when my son was crying, his twin sister would go and comfort him with her favorite toy dog, which was a kindly, sympathetic gesture, but really not much use to him at all.
Yeah.
Fast forward a year, when they're about 2.5, and when my son was crying, his sister would go and comfort him with his favorite toy cat. Right? Yeah. That's the leap of empathy, recognizing that other people have different tastes. And she hadn't even read George Bernard Shaw, and she got it. And this is very important, because that's how we respond appropriately to other people's needs. We shouldn't assume other people care about the same things as us or have the same beliefs. They might have very different interests and desires, and we need to respond to them.
This is an important part of your book, this idea that, and we'll dig in here as we go, but that empathy requires real work. That is, it requires, I think, action. It requires a leap of faith. I mean, you've got to actually get into the trenches here. And maybe this is what you mean when you talk, which we'll get into a little bit more later, but by taking an imaginative leap, is that what you mean?
That's absolutely right, that we need to work hard in terms of how our minds work to try and put ourselves in other people's shoes, because there are so many barriers in society. For example, we so often prejudge people based on what they look like, their accents, and so on, and we're so often wrong about people. I mean, just to give you an example, I used to live around the corner from a homeless guy who I walked past for years and never really thought I had much in common with him. He was always muttering to himself in a slightly crazy way. And one day I stopped to talk to him and realized and discovered that he actually had a philosophy degree from Oxford University, and we developed a friendship based on our mutual interest in moral philosophy and pepperoni pizza, right? But what it tells us is that we need to work hard at imagining ourselves in other people's positions and to humanize them. Yeah. I mean, Mahatma Gandhi famously said something about how to make this empathic leap. It's what's known as Gandhi's talisman. It's like a little rule of thumb he came up with just before he was assassinated. And what he said was this. He said, whenever you're in doubt or when the self is too much with you, apply the following test. Recall the face of the poorest man who you may have seen and ask yourself if the step you contemplate is going to be of any use to him. Then you'll find your doubts and yourself melting away. So that's what Gandhi said, and it really is about trying to make a conscious effort of focusing on other people's feelings and needs and lives.
The book is full of examples, the people who are empathic. And I wanted to work through a couple of these stories as we go. Let's start with Patricia Moore, because she's one of these examples that really helps us get our bearings in terms of trying to be immerse yourself really into the lives of others and be empathic. Tell us about Patricia Moore.
Yeah, Patricia Moore is a really extraordinary figure. Not many people know her, although she's one of the most influential Americans of the last century. And she's actually a designer, a product and industrial designer. You might think, well, what relevance of that is to my life? Well, let me tell you about her story. That back in the 1970s, she was working as a designer at one of America's most famous design firms in Manhattan called Raymond Loewy. They designed the curvy Coca-Cola bottle. Yeah. And she was in a meeting as a 26-year-old designer with a bunch of men. They were all men designers there. She was the only woman. And she asked one of the male partners when they were talking about the design of a fridge door, couldn't we design that refrigerator door, she said, so it was easy for an older person with arthritis to open. And one of these senior male partners said to her, Patricia, you know, we just don't design for those people. And that made her really angry. And she decided to conduct an empathy immersion to physically find out what was it like to be an 85-year-old woman with arthritis. So she hired a makeup artist to make her look sort of old and wrinkled. She put on fogged up glasses so she couldn't see and plugs in her ears, bandaged up her arms with splints and her hands so she couldn't open fridge doors or use tin openers. And she went out onto the streets and visited over 100 U.S. cities in her disguise as an 85-year-old. She really looked 85, even though she was only 26, to see how people treated her, what was it like going up and down subway stairs, in and out of department stores, using tin openers and opening fridge doors. And at the end of her experiment, this real empathy immersion, becoming another person, she came up with a whole load of amazing innovations that we all know about, even though we don't know her name. So if you open your kitchen drawer, you'll probably find one of those thick rubber-handled tin openers or potato peelers.
Yeah.
That's her invention. It's called the OXO Good Grip. It's so people with arthritis can use utensils and continue to be independent people so they don't get shoved off into the ghettos we call care homes or rest homes. So she really used empathy in a creative way to actually really transform people's lives.
So this is an example for you in the sense that this is what you're getting at, is the idea of, as Patty Moore does, she really takes design in a completely new direction. It has this impact, becomes known as universal design. It has this impact all around the world. And you're saying that's how empathy can work, is you employ these techniques and you can actually transform, you know, the way we, I mean, think about all these design things that she influenced. That's what you're getting at here with the book, I guess.
Absolutely. She innovated the world of design. As you say, she invented the idea of universal design, that any object like a cup or the chair I'm sitting on right now should be designed so it can be used by a 5-year-old or an 85-year-old. And we can take that idea of immersing ourselves in other people's lives and extend it in all sorts of ways. I mean, for example, just a couple of months ago, tens of thousands of Americans took part in an anti-poverty program called Live Below the Line. And what they did was an empathy immersion, a bit different from Patricia Moore's. What they did was to live on $1.25 a day for 5 days in solidarity with the 1 billion people on the earth who live on that amount of money. So they're getting a little bit of a taste of their lives, a kind of simulation. And those experiences, those very physical ones, can really change us. I mean, we don't forget them.
It's The idea of empathy, of course, you mentioned, and I wanted to spend a few moments with this idea, sort of the history of it. I mean, it really emerges, I guess, in the 18th century. We know humans have the impulse to be self-interested, as you say, but over the last few years, we're now learning we're hardwired for empathy. And I wanted you to say something about what you think. We're in this kind of transition of thinking in the Cartesian age. Explain what you mean. It goes beyond this idea of I think, therefore I am, to you are, therefore I am. Explain the difference there.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you go back to the 18th century when empathy became popular, the great father of capitalism, in fact, Adam Smith, most people know him for having written a book called The Wealth of Nations, which was all about free market economics. But actually, 17 years before that, he wrote a book in 1759 called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, a kind of forgotten text. And in that, it was a theory of empathy. What he said was that human morality is based on our ability to what he called change places in fancy with the sufferer. In other words, to put ourselves in other people's shoes. But what happened, looking at the big historical view, is that while these ideas around empathy were common in the 18th century, they became overtaken by the idea of rationality, as you mentioned there, the Cartesian age, seeing ourselves as rational, self-interested creatures. And only now, in the last 20 years or so, are we beginning to challenge that idea and recognize that the old age of I think, therefore I am is being overtaken by a new one of you are, therefore I am, an empathic age where our sense of self, we're starting to realize is who we are, is partly based on our ability to connect with others, empathize, and see through their eyes. And the great revolution has really come through neuroscience, that since the 1990s, there's been an enormous amount of research showing that our brains are, hardwired for empathy, that, if you damage a particular part of your brain, you might lose the ability to recognize fear or other emotions on somebody else's face. And this is absolutely fundamental to who we are. And only now is it starting to filter in to education systems and the media and so on, a recognition that, we are these empathic creatures, and it makes total sense to try to nurture that side of who we are.
You mentioned that there's just a tiny fraction, like 2% of people. I mean, we're talking of some maybe on the autism spectrum and psychopaths, of course. I mean, but 98% of the rest of us have this capacity. I think there's something hopeful in there because we all tend to think that maybe some have it, maybe some don't. What you're saying is for the most part, this is what it means to be human in some ways, is that we empathize.
Absolutely. That's completely how I see it. There is this tiny percentage of people who are empathically challenged, as it were, according to research by autism experts like Simon Baron Cohen at Cambridge University in England. There's a small percentage who, for example, the sociopath or psychopath might be able to step into your shoes, do that cognitive leap, but make no emotional or affective connection with you. And equally, some people on the autism spectrum, such as those with Asperger's, there is a lot of debate about this still, but it seems the evidence points to the fact that they might be able to emotionally connect, feel emotions very strongly, but again, they find it difficult to kind of step into someone else's perspective and look through their eyes, or they can only do so when the context is right and when they feel very secure, for example, with their family members who they know. But otherwise, we are kind of born with this very social side of ourselves. Of course, the ancient Greeks recognized this too. Aristotle, the philosopher, famously said that human beings are social animals, as gregarious as bees. We live in groups and always have done. And we've adapted in an evolutionary sense to that. We survive in groups by cooperating with each other so that we can protect ourselves from predators or share food. This is the historical evolutionary story, and this is still part of who we are today. And any parent who responds to the hunger cries of their child are responding to that deep evolutionary empathic recognition. I don't think we can really ignore this side of who we are, but as you say, it takes work to bring out our empathic potential.
Okay, so we talked about that all of us are hardwired then for this capacity for empathy, but there's a problem because right now in history, you say, we're suffering from this deficit, what you call an acute empathy deficit. Explain what you mean.
Well, it's really interesting. There's a lot of data on how empathy levels have changed through time. Now, empathy is pretty tough to measure, but there have been measures done by psychologists, surveys for over 40 or 50 years. And what they show in a very famous study recently that empathy levels amongst U.S. college students, for example, have dropped by nearly 50% over the last three decades, and the steepest decline has been in the last 10 years.
Wow.
And at the same time, we've seen rising levels of narcissism, and we know very well that the more Facebook interactions you have, for instance, the more narcissistic you're likely to be. And thinking again about online culture, where we're seeing an acute erosion of empathy, a recent research by the Pew Research Center tells us that 73% of Americans have experienced online abuse, harassment, and trolling. So there's a real issue going on, particularly in the digital world, but not only there, of empathic decline. And of course, famously, Barack Obama in the lead up to the 2008 presidential elections talked about America's empathy deficit. And I don't think it's really gone away.
So, it's as you say, it's hard to measure this kind of stuff and to make a causal connection between levels of depression, levels of narcissism. But do you think there is a, I mean, it seems fairly strong there, the connection between technology and that deficit?
Absolutely. And I think that technology is something we need to be thinking hard about. If you're interested, like me, in trying to expand empathy in society and put it to use, draw on its power to overcome social divides, we need to think about what technology is doing to us. And I don't want to sound like too much of a technological kind of Neanderthal, but I think that all the evidence shows that, for example, most social networking platforms are designed for the efficient exchange of information, not of empathy. I mean, how many people can tweet their different emotions in 140 characters? You know, and if you're a Japanese haiku poet, can you really do that? And at the same time, we know, of course, that there are 2.7 billion people online and more phones in sub-Saharan Africa than there are in Western Europe. You would think this would be an enormous opportunity for empathic connection between people of different cultures and generations. Now, a certain amount of that happens. So, for example, I recently came across a wonderful empathy-building project, which was teenagers in Brazil who want to learn English from a native English speaker got themselves in touch via Skype and other video technologies with elders in a care home in Chicago who were very lonely. But those elders in Chicago started teaching them English online, face-to-face, and they did something very useful, but they also created an empathic connection across cultures and generations. That was using technology for good, and empathic good, but that isn't the usual story yet. We still need to work pretty hard to turn technology and digital culture, such as violent video games, around and put it towards expanding our empathy.
Here's a comment from Ted, who writes from Midvale, Utah. He says, empathy is sorely lacking in our modern world. I learned a lot about empathy from the writer David Foster Wallace. Much of his fiction deals with the challenges of truly understanding each other. Ted writes about the Kenyon College commencement address that Foster Wallace gave in 2005. And in fact, he says, I keep this quote in my wallet. Our own present culture, this is David Foster Wallace now, our own present culture has yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. But the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty, unsexy ways every day. Do you think that gets at what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And anybody who's heard that commencement address by David Foster Wallace will recognize that really he takes you on an empathic journey there, and you can read it online, but also watch it on YouTube or listen to a rendition on YouTube. And you know, he really tries to get you to see other people for the individuals who they are. To imagine, you know, you're in that supermarket queue and you're feeling impatient, you want to get to the front of the queue, and but so are all the people in front of you, you know, and they're not just trying to make your life hard by getting in your way, but they are real people with their own concerns and their own lives. We need to try and imagine ourselves in their position to try and have an awareness of people around us and not just be looking inside ourselves. I mean, I think of this as a distinction between what I call introspection and outrospection. Yeah. You know, introspection very much about, you know, looking inside ourselves for the answers of who we are, but outrospection about really having an awareness of others, learning about life through the vision of others. And interestingly, that David Foster Wallace address is one of the most popular items on a project I recently set up called the Empathy Library, which is an online project at www.empathylibrary.com, which is full of videos and novels and films all about stepping into other people's shoes. So I'm glad that that particular commencement address really went viral. I mean, tens of millions of people have listened to it.
I'm glad you mentioned the Empathy Library. We were going to get to it a little bit later, but I should mention we'll have a link to that on our website. And in fact, we have a video site connected to Radio West called Video West. And in our favorite section, we're featuring an animated short that explains that difference. I'm sure we got it from you, I think, Roman Krasnarek, and the library itself, which describes that difference between empathy and sympathy. Yeah,
that's right. I imagine it's a 2-minute animated video by Brené Brown, who's, you know, really thought a lot about empathy and its role in emotional life, and it's fantastic and it's very funny. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. Well, you have all kinds of things. I mean, you have nonfiction in that library. I like the fiction part too, though. You know, Zadie Smith and George Eliot, and films too. Gandhi is among them. So I guess this is part of it, the idea of exposing yourself to these kinds of stories where people can relate, have empathy.
That's right. I mean, we can't always do something like Patricia Moore did, which I talked about earlier, about sort of dressing up as an 85-year-old or physically immersing ourselves in someone else's lives. It's, you know, not something that's we can all do that easily all the time. But what we can do is take those imaginative journeys of empathy by reading books and watching films. And we all know that that can have a big impact on us. I mean, we all know that the central line of a book like To Kill a Mockingbird is, you never really understand another person until you step inside of his skin and walk around in it for a while. And it's a very powerful message about empathic imagining and taking those journeys from your armchair at home by watching films, reading books is a really great way of entering other people's lives that you wouldn't otherwise know about.
I want to get to some of these six habits of highly empathic people. But before that, there's a disclaimer here to all of this that you put in the book. And you say, let's be realistic. Empathy is not a panacea. And there are some, I guess, downsides. There's some surprising downsides to empathy. And I wanted you to mention this. The question of whether it's possible to empathize too much, and also this matter of whether empathy can be used to manipulate people.
Yes, there's certainly questions about the power of empathy. You know, empathy isn't a panacea for everything. I think one of the limits of empathy that people often come across sometimes is the idea of too much empathy, that people can see an image, for example, of a suffering child on TV and feel overwhelmed by it, almost paralyzed by it. And that's real for, you know, a percentage of the population, that sense of affective empathy overwhelming us. Now, people who tend to work in very emotionally traumatic kind of situations, like, you know, cancer ward nurses or humanitarian aid workers who face the possibility of empathic overload quite a lot, tend to find ways to protect themselves. I mean, in other words, they kind of fit their own oxygen mask before fitting somebody else's. So, you know, someone who works on a suicide line won't take one call after the other. You know, they will take a call and then have a break, maybe have a debriefing with colleagues. That we need to, in a way, know where our personal limits are and step back if it is becoming a little bit too much for us, too much of what psychologists call empathic overarousal. But there are, you know, other challenges with empathy as well, as you mentioned there, that empathy can be used in some sense to manipulate others. And certainly the thing that I'm a little bit wary of, or quite a lot wary of, is something that's become known as empathy marketing. Yeah. And this is a new term, just been around for a few years. And this is the idea of being able to step into your clients or your customers' shoes in order to, you know, get them to buy more of your stuff. Or in other words, it's stepping into other people's shoes in order to get them to buy another pair.
Right.
And the problem here, of course, is that, you know, a fast food company wants to step into the shoes of my six-year-old twins in order to sell them more hamburgers and French fries and send them on a fast track to heart disease. And I'm not particularly happy about that. But what's really going on with that kind of empathy marketing is that I wouldn't really call it empathy marketing. I think it's just marketing. It's stepping into other people's shoes, but not making any emotional connection with them, no concern for their welfare. But we should certainly be wary of it.
You've also talked about Errol Morris's documentary, The Fog of War, as another one of these examples of, in this particular case, Robert McNamara kind of manipulating this idea of empathy in the context of war.
Yes, McNamara is a really interesting figure, of course, a former U.S. Secretary of Defense, and that great film, The Fog of War, a biopic made by Errol Morris, in which McNamara spells out his top 10, or top 11, in fact, lessons from foreign policy making. And his first great lesson, he says, is to empathize with your enemies. And he's trying to make a serious point. He says that, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the crisis was resolved because key members of the Kennedy administration were able to step into the shoes of the Russians, particularly Khrushchev and some key diplomats who personally knew Khrushchev and his wife. And they were able to think of what Khrushchev was trying to do, step into his shoes, and then find a solution to the Cuban Missile problem. And in a way, that looks very positive, a good use of empathy. But on the other hand, that idea of, let's say, stepping into other people's shoes in order just to understand their minds effectively so you could potentially beat them in the foreign policy playing field is, I think, maybe reducing empathy to too much of an instrumental tool, something that you just use to get your own way. So I think it's quite complex, and I think it's definitely worth people having a look at that film, The Fog of War, to get McNamara's view on the power of empathy.
Roman Krusnarek is with us. His book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you. And sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the philosopher, thinker, writer Roman Krusnarek. We're talking about his book, Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. So I want to work through some of these six habits of empathic people that you write about. And I don't want to go in particular order necessarily, because I want to start with number three, because there's this larger theme in your book, which is about travel, that empathy is like taking a journey. And one of my favorite stories in the book is about George Orwell, who took these sort of empathic adventures or journeys.
Yeah, that's right. The George Orwell, of course, most people know him as a novelist who wrote 1984 and Animal Farm. But what a lot of people don't realize that he was from quite a privileged background. He went to England's most exclusive school, Eton. He was a police officer in the colonial police force in Burma in the 1920s. And when he came back to England, he realized he didn't know how the other half lived. He decided then to become a tramp, a hobo, and live on the streets of East London. He sold his nice suit, got himself tramping clothes and a flat cap, and went out onto the streets, sometimes for a few days at a time, sometimes for weeks at a time, going out penniless, spending his time with vagabonds and hobos and beggars and sleeping in doss houses. Mm-hmm. And he famously wrote about this experience in his book, Down and Out in Paris and London. And what really happened to Orwell by getting a little bit of a taste of poverty was that it blew away his prejudices about homeless people. It expanded his curiosity about strangers, and of course gave him a lot of literary material on which to base later books. But he was part of a longer tradition of investigative reporters trying to discover how people in poverty lived. I mean, Jack London in the early 1900s had gone to the same part of East London and spent several weeks pretending to be an unemployed seaman. And he wrote about that in his book, The People of the Abyss, about the extraordinary poverty of people living in London, that the centre of the great British Empire at the time. He couldn't believe that people were so poor. It was extraordinary.
So what do you recommend that we find our own adventures? I mean, within the, you know, within the possibilities of our own lives, but find ways of getting out and experiencing other people in their situations, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I think we all have to find our own roots. You know, not everybody wants to necessarily have insights into the nature of poverty, especially you might be from that kind of background yourself. But let's take another example, like religion. You know, if you happen to be a fervent believer in your particular religion, one empathy experiment to do would be to spend a month going to the services of a different religion every Sunday or whenever that service is, and maybe even go to a meeting of humanists. Of course, this is exactly what Nelson Mandela did when he was in prison on Robben Island for all those years under apartheid. He was brought up as a Methodist, but went to every single religious service and in a way got a taste of every faith group. And I think those kinds of experiments, in this case in the area of religion, are what breeds tolerance and respect and understanding. And we can all do things like that, which are experiential immersions. On the other hand, you know, if you happen to be a college student thinking of going away for a year, you know, you may well think of volunteering in a developing country, building houses for indigenous people in Guatemala, or volunteering as a school teacher in rural Thailand. I mean, we can all do stuff like this even on our 2-week vacation, spend a week of it doing a bit of an empathy immersion. And in fact, it's normally those are the vacations that we really remember, not sipping cocktails by the poolside.
It's interesting about one of the things you write about is how we switch on our empathic brains. This is, in fact, number one, how you bring these circuits that we have hardwired into our system, how you bring them back to life. And this particular chapter begins with a reference to Star Trek and Spock's famous mind meld. And I wanted you to talk about that because there may be something scientific to this idea of Spock.
Yes, of course, we all laugh at Spock as being the great rationalist, but of course, you know, close followers of Star Trek will know that he had this amazing mind-melding capacity. He could put his hands on or near another creature and feel their pain, which he did famously in several key episodes. And of course, this is about affective empathy. He's feeling other people's emotions. And that science fiction is, in many ways, science fact. And one of the ways that actually works, our Spock-like abilities are part of us through what are known as mirror neurons. And these are neurons in our brains which fire not only when we feel pain, but when we see somebody else in pain. Or not only when we feel fear, but when we see somebody else in fear. And they are an essential component of our empathic circuitry. There is some debate about them because the original mirror neuron experiments were done on a particular kind of monkey, which is a very nasty species without a shred of empathy. But the evidence suggests that these mirror neurons are part of our neural circuitry, which helps spark our empathic brains. And when I say that a great habit of empathic people is to sort of spark your empathic brain or to switch on your empathic brain, what I mean partly is to really learn about this science of empathy as a foundation for your larger empathy adventures in life. Because we've got a lot of propaganda to challenge, the propaganda being that the idea that we're basically self-interested creatures. Yeah. The science is telling us the opposite, but we really need to be learning that. And school kids need to be learning that as well to really make us focus more on bringing out empathy in society.
Because that changes their attitude about it all.
It absolutely changes their attitude. But you know, you can go beyond that by actually teaching empathy in schools. And there are, as I talk about in that particular chapter of the book, wonderful empathy teaching programs. One began in Canada, it spread to the US and other countries, called Roots of Empathy. And the way it works, and this is true, by the way, a class of elementary school kids adopt a baby, a real-life baby for the year.
Yeah.
And the baby comes into the class, admittedly with a parent and an instructor from the program. And the kids sit around the baby and they start talking about this baby. Why is she crying? What's she feeling or thinking? What's going on? And they're trying to step into the baby's shoes. And they use that as a jumping off point for then talking about what's it like to be bullied in the playground, what's it like to be a kid in a wheelchair. They're trying to expand empathy. And it not only increases empathy level, this program that over 500,000 kids have done, but it also increases general academic attainment, reduces bullying, increases social cooperation. But it's all ways of switching on the empathic brains of young people and really rewiring or wiring those networks in our brains so they become empathic throughout their life course.
What does it mean to make the imaginative leap toward empathy? This is another one of those six habits.
What I mean by that is to consciously focus on other people's feelings and needs and different perspectives and to make a habit of that. And it's extraordinary how powerful that is for changing our behavior. Let me give you an example. There's a famous psychology experiment done at the University of Kansas by a guy called Dan Batson, who's the world's expert on altruism. And he got two groups of people to listen to the same radio recording of a woman in distress. And he asked the first group to just listen to the objective facts of that recording of this woman who'd actually had her parents killed in a car accident. And the second group, he said, imagine yourself in that woman's position. Imagine seeing things from her perspective and how she thinks and feels. And it was that second group that not only had higher empathy levels, but were much more willing to give money and time to help the woman out and other resources. And that was even controlling for differences of religion or gender or social and economic background. In other words, just imagining yourself in someone else's position expands our moral concern for them and motivates us to take action on their behalves. And that's an extraordinary capacity that we all have.
You write about the barriers to taking that leap. The four biggies here: prejudice, authority, distance, denial. Prejudice that makes sense, and you do make that point in the book. But what really interested me was, aside from prejudice, you say our tendency to obey authority is one of the greatest obstacles to empathy.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. There was a famous experiment done in the early 1960s that some of your listeners might know about, done at Yale, called the Milgram test. Mm-hmm. And what happened in this test was that people were invited into the lab and they were told by a man in a very official-looking lab coat to administer an electric shock to someone in another room if they answered a memory test question wrong.
Right.
And if they got another question, the person got another question wrong, the subject was supposed to administer even greater electric shock. And the very shocking result of Stan Milgram's experiment was that 65% of people would administer electric shocks that would kill another person if they were told by an authority figure to do so. And the result, Milgram said, was that it actually showed that the way we obey authority so readily can overcome any empathic instincts that we have. And he was particularly thinking about what happened in Nazi Germany, that people kept saying, look, I worked in the death camps, but I was just following orders. I was just following the rules and obeying the law. But what's interesting to me is that when you look at Milgram's data and in replications of experiment, if, yes, 65% of people administer electric shocks which will kill others, but if you bring the person who's getting the shock into the same room as you and you could see them, you'll only 20% of people would administer dangerous shocks. And if you have someone else in the same room of you who's refusing to do the tests and disobeying authority, almost nobody will administer dangerous shocks. So in solidarity, our empathy comes out.
Let's go to the phones. Pat is with us. Pat is calling from Salt Lake. Pat, hi.
Hi. John Rawls was a Harvard philosopher, died a few years ago, who had his theory of justice, which included a different variation than what Gandhi had said, and that was essentially think of every action you take as to its impact on the least advantage, and if it's negative, you shouldn't do it. If it's positive, you should do it. Why hasn't that taken hold in America?
<That's a good question. laughs> Roman
That's
Kusnarik
a great question.
That is a great question.
That's a great question. So, of course, this is from John Rawls, the philosopher's famous book, The Theory of Justice, which he wrote back in the 70s, which has had, you know, nearly 50 years to spread around. And certainly it's taken hold amongst philosophy students who all have to read his book, and political philosophy students, as I did 25 years ago when I was a student. But in fact, Rawls, in a way, was very much thinking about empathy. You know, another part of his thinking, of course, and as Pat no doubt knows, was his idea of what was called the veil of ignorance, which was, you know, to imagine yourself, if you imagine a world where you really didn't know what position you would be born into, whether you'd be born rich or poor, black or white or whatever, then on that basis, what kind of world would you design? Mm-hmm. If you were could imagine yourself in almost everybody's, you know, pairs of shoes. And this was part of how he developed his idea of a theory of justice. Of course, that it's a great, I think, thought experiment. The question of why it hasn't taken hold is a pretty complex one, and I think it has to do with all sorts of factors, like, you know, the culture of individualism which we've inherited from the last century. You know, back in the 1970s, just when John Rawls was writing, the journalist Tom Wolfe famously called the 70s the Great Me Decade, the decade in which we were all so self-obsessed, and that this was a product of, you know, the advertising industry and all sorts of other factors, and the self-help industry, which was always telling us to look after ourselves. So I think there are big cultural factors which explain why unfortunately, John Rawls's difference principle and his veil of ignorance aren't all at the forefront of our minds.
Pat, glad you called. Thanks very much. Back to the phones. Mike is with us in Ogden, Utah. Mike, hi.
Hi, Doug. Hey, I was wondering if the author or anybody that he knows has ever done any studies on the levels of empathy contributing to one's political persuasion or party or basic premises of belief, where, you know, liberalism versus conservatism mostly.
Wait, are you asking, are Republicans or more or less empathic than Democrats?
Empathic selfishness.
I'm guessing Roman.
I've found extremes in both parties.
Got it. No, wait. I'm sure you've heard that question, Roman Kusnarik.
There is some research.
Such
on
an
this.
American question, right?
It's an American question, but of course one that makes sense in a question in a political situation.
Absolutely.
Where there is so much us versus them animosity and partisanship in the political system. You know, particularly following the recent, you know, midterm elections. Mm-hmm. And, of course, what the evidence shows so far, and there aren't a lot of studies of this, but what the evidence shows is that active Republican voters have lower empathy levels than active Democrat voters. So on some fundamental measures, it seems that, you know, those on the left have more empathy than those on the right. But the way I would qualify that, though, by saying that everybody, wherever you are on the political spectrum, has that same level of empathy wired into them, as it were.
Yeah.
And different things can bring it out. Wherever you are on the political spectrum, you know, you can still have that capacity to step into other people's shoes. But of course, the policy tools which you might adopt in order to respond to that imaginative stepping into other people's shoes might differ depending, again, where you are in the political spectrum. You know,
well, this is also a very important point that you make, and that is I remember hearing you say we need to be willing to empathize even with those that aren't maybe terribly sympathetic, big corporate business leaders, for example. And you can apply that same message politically. If you have a particular political persuasion, it seems the way around this political mess that we're in right now is to try to empathize with someone of the other political party. That is what you're getting at in the book in some ways.
I absolutely am getting at that in the book. And let me just give you an example of how I've tried to work on this in practical terms. I used to run an organization which created what are called conversation meals. And what we did is we invited people to sit down, people from different religions or CEOs sitting down with homeless people or people of different political persuasions. And what we do is we invite them to a meal, and instead of giving them a menu of food, we give them a menu of conversation. And on that menu, there'll be questions about life, like what have you learned about the different varieties of love in your life, or in what ways would you like to be more courageous? And we do, in a way, the opposite of speed dating. You talk to someone in a pair for 1 hour, not for 1 minute. But these were very serious events. And when I think of something like the US and the Democrat-Republican split, I think that if you could sit down people, even neighbors on opposite sides of the political fence with one of these menus of conversation, and get them to recognize that they have an enormous amount in common, whether they care about family life or social justice or all sorts of different things, that they're not people of a different species, as it were, that you'd realize and people would realize that there is a lot more common than they understand that and stop sort of labeling people so much. I think kind of empathic conversation is one of the ways that we can really help overcome such splits and differences.
And we should also point out that you have this menu, really, for conversations in your book, the idea of how you can get these conversations started and how to work through them.
Absolutely. You can go to the page on the book, which has a list of questions, and go and sit down with your neighbor who's from the opposite side of the political belief system and actually use them to prompt a conversation and see what it does. And it is extraordinary how talking to another person, looking them in the eye, and actually listening to them, what they have to say, can really help create connection across even the most extraordinary social divides. And, you know, just to give you an example.
Just a quick one. We're about out of time, but go ahead.
Well, just an example of that is just how in everyday life people argue with their partners all the time. And you sometimes just wish, God, I wish that person could see things from my point of view. I wish they could step into my shoes. You're asking for empathy, stepping to the other people's position. And that works for politics as well as in relationships. By listening to the other person, listening out for their feelings and needs, you can create an empathic connection.
Mm. Roman Krusnarek, his book is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It, joined us from the studios today of the BBC in Oxford. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for having me on the program, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. With thanks to Michael Shea, technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.